You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of November 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Pope Francis touches down in Myanmar. Is it polite for a guest to mention the ethnic cleansing? My guests Ivor Gaber and Mary Dajewski will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the latest installment of Britain's perennial failure to consider, much less understand, Ireland, what conservative billionaire brothers want with one of the world's best-known current affairs journals, and can you legislate misogynist language out of existence? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Ivor Gaber, Professor of Journalism at the University of Sussex, and Mary Dajewski, a columnist for The Independent and The Guardian. Welcome both. And we will start in Myanmar today, hosting its first ever visit by a pope. When this trip was first planned, assuming that the Holy See is not given to spontaneity and that these things are arranged some months in advance, it probably looked something of a milk run. Pose for photo with the secular saint Aung San Suu Kyi, issue sonorous encomium to the country's progress towards openness and democracy, returned to Rome. It has become rather trickier than that, following Myanmar's pogrom against its Muslim minority, which has chased at least 600,000 people into neighbouring Bangladesh. Ivor, first of all, there is much angst, apparently, over whether Francis should in public utter the word Rohingya, which is, of course, the name of that Muslim minority, but the Myanmarese authorities would seem to prefer it if he didn't.
Yeah, I've been reading some sort of diplomatic dancing around the words where he says the group of people who some people refer to as Rohingyas. But there is, and I understand why that might be sensible, given the proclivities to surprising violence, I suppose, for us who don't know much about Buddhism and always thought Buddhist monks practiced pacifism. I suppose the Pope wouldn't want to say anything that would deliberately provoke violence during his visit. However, I do think there's a big principle at stake here. It's a bit like, just to give an extreme example, in visiting Nazi Germany and not referring to Jews, but talking about cosmopolitans, where you are colluding with the ethnic oppression of that particular group. He's a courageous man. So I think there's an interesting issue here whether he should say the words, because by saying them, he would be making an important statement, but there's a big risk. So I don't know. What should he do? That's the big question.
Mary, the Pope has supposed to have been meeting today with General Min Aung Hlaing, who is the person generally believed to have been orchestrating actions, if indeed that is the word, against the Rohingyas in Rakhine State. Is there any reason why he would listen to Pope Francis, or might he get a bit all how many divisions has the Pope?
No, he might, and especially because it's such a tiny minority. I think it's about 1%
Catholics in Myanmar. Catholics. Yes, it's about that.
So you sort of ask, well, what constituency does he have? But I think almost ever since John Paul II, a pope has had a sort of global presence at a time when trust in secular politicians seems to be universally so low. There does seem to be something about, you know, a pope who seems to be sort of above the local political frays in various, above local wars. And I suppose that's what he brings to it. Also, Pope Francis has, you know, he has a particular personality. He appears very outgoing. His early life was in Latin America. And so he comes as almost the supreme internationalist. Of course, that doesn't mean that anybody's going to listen to him or that he has, you know, any power over, as it were, the disputing parties. Nonetheless, you do think, well, maybe he could do a bit of good.
He is in a weird diplomatic position, isn't he, Ivor? Well, any pope is, because obviously he's not elected to the office except by a cabal of cardinals who make a decision to which none of the rest of us are privy. In Myanmar in particular, as Mary points out, his actual religious constituency is infinitesimal. Might it have made a stronger statement if he just announced, I'm not going?
Well, I think that would have been the easy way out, and I don't think this Pope takes the easy way out. And I'm struck by this point that Mary's raised about the Pope as an international figure. Pope John Paul, the Polish Pope, was very influential in the crumbling of the Soviet Empire.
But he was obviously Polish and did lead a church which had a huge constituency in Eastern Europe, in Poland in particular.
He did, but he did speak with a very loud voice on these issues, and he was an exemplar of the Pope as international diplomat. But to come back to your question, should he have declared, "I'm not going," I think that would have been, for me to say, who am I to say it, but I think that would have been a mistake. I do think by him going, apart from the 1% Catholics in Myanmar, I think his visit, if he does mention the dreaded Rohingya word, would do an awful lot for the damage, the shattered morale of the Rohingya people, who must be feeling in a dreadful position, and here comes a major international figure expressing some sort of solidarity with them. And on that basis, I do think he should have gone.
I think there's another interesting point to add to this. As I understand it, his next stop on this particular journey is to Bangladesh.
Indeed.
So in a way, even if it's by accident, he does almost have a unique opportunity as somebody who comes flying in from outside, who really has nothing to do with this dispute of what has been called, and I think validly, ethnic cleansing at very least, that he has an opportunity to talk to two sides who are probably not talking to each other, whether he can do anything, because obviously without a constituency on the ground, his actual power is quite limited. But even so, being something of a sort of envoy between the two, that's probably more than's been going on for the last few years.
So you think his very detachment from Myanmar and from the situation actually gives him a certain power?
I think it may enable him to talk to both sides in a way that somebody else who maybe belongs to either side or has taken a particular side thus far doesn't have the ability to do.
Well, perhaps we could send him next to Northern Ireland, because let's look now at episode umpty dozen in an apparently infinite series of things we should probably have thought about before the Brexit vote. It is becoming increasingly apparent that atop any number of other headaches, the UK has brought down upon itself the 21st century equivalent of the Schleswig-Holstein question, i.e. an unsolvable diplomatic conundrum likely to drive to demented cackling anybody who thinks about it longer than 10 seconds. Specifically, it is the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, which after Brexit must simultaneously exist, yet not exist. Ivor, I'm going to give you 20 seconds or less to explain this one for our viewers who may have, viewers, listeners, who may now be at the stage of dropping dead with boredom at the mention of the word Brexit.
Well, I'll give you a picture. I used to work in Northern Ireland as a reporter during what was known as the Troubles. And this notion of the border gives you an idea of some sort of large, major road and border police stopping people. The border, which is a totally artificial border, consists of 20, 30 major minor roads and hundreds of tracks. It is the only way it was policed during the Troubles was with watchtowers which could cover 6 or 7 roads and helicopters. And there are enough, your word demented, not mine, IRA or real IRA or whatever, Republican activists still in the north who would see a British army, a British watchtower or a British helicopter as an irresistible target. Now, I don't think I'm exaggerating. When you go to Northern Ireland, as I still do, feelings still run deep. And I think there's a very real issue here that I'm afraid in the Brexit debate, with the honourable exception of John Major and Tony Blair, nobody referred to. And I think it's a conundrum. And despite the wisdom of you, me and Mary, I don't think tonight we're going to get a solution to it. It's a real conundrum.
Come on, we've got another 5 or 6 minutes. Don't be so faint-hearted, Ivor. Mary, the latest bright idea uttered today by the MP Kate Hoey, who is one of those... stop tittering, Ivor. She's an MP. She deserves our thoroughgoing respect. She's one of that curious clerk of lefty leavers, Mary. Her brilliant idea, and I'm not making this up for our overseas listeners, this is an actual Member of Parliament, has suggested that after Brexit, Britain should simply not bother to build any kind of border at all, and therefore if the EU decides there has to be a border, then that becomes the Republic of Ireland's problem.
Yes, I think Kate Hoey is obviously living in slightly different territory, both geographical and political, from the rest of us.
Very tactfully put.
I actually have thought for a very, very long time that the Irish question, as it might be put, and as incidentally people in the Republic of Ireland, their politicians, they call it the British question, is one of the most intractable of all the problems thrown up by Brexit. This is the one that is, to my mind, absolutely hardest to fix. And I really don't see how it can be done. I mean, my favourite compromise, if you like, is the one that's been mooted by the Republic of Ireland, which is that there is a sort of border that runs down the Irish Sea, and that Northern Ireland becomes part of, for economic and trade purposes, becomes part of an overall trade bloc, sort of almost honorary European area membership. But of course, the Northern Ireland Unionists and the British government, which now depends on the Northern Ireland Unionists to have a majority in Parliament, they absolutely say that this is totally out of the question, because it would seem to separate Northern Ireland from the rest of the United Kingdom, and they're not prepared to accept that. And of course, there's a sort of bracket, a sort of coda to this, which says, and of course, we see this as another step in the direction of a united Ireland. My view is that actually a united Ireland would be the best way to deal with this, but we're a very, very long way from that.
And that is, of course, for any number of reasons, far from a simple proposition either. Ivor, Ireland's Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, who has domestic political problems of his own, which we probably don't have time to get in with today, but he has told the UK government that he wants a written guarantee that there will be no hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic. Now, can the government of the UK in all good conscience provide that?
It depends on how much faith they put in it. I'm just going to refer back, and then I'll come forward, that they don't have to. They've got 10 days before the next crucial meeting.
Is it 10? I thought it's just 7. Is it December 4th?
I'm not very good at maths.
No, it's just 7.
Anyway, the point I was making is they don't have to have solved this problem. I'm here now trying to throw a shaft of light. They have to demonstrate progress. Now, if the British government offering to think about giving a guarantee, or whatever the wording is, can be represented as progress, then I won't say all bets are on, but certainly all bets aren't off. And I do think that we're now coming to crunch time when Mrs. May or Mr. Davis or any of the Brexit team, if they don't show some degree of flexibility, even by saying we're going to look at this issue and we're going to try and solve it without a hard border, or whatever the form of words are, there's still a fighting chance they might get their nod, yes, progress is being made, we'll start trade talks, which of course is the holy grail of this negotiation, which we haven't got to yet.
One of the reasons that might stop us from getting to it is, of course, that Ireland, like, you know, any other EU member country can veto any part of this process whenever it feels like it. That being the case, Mary, it's hard to avoid noticing in certain of the Brexiteer rhetoric that has emerged about this in recent weeks, the latest iteration of a familiar pattern, i.e. This thing that we campaigned for, believing that it probably wouldn't happen and therefore we could just carry on whining about it, has actually happened. We do now have to take responsibility for it. None of it's actually workable. We can't figure out how to do any of this, so who can we blame? Their lapse into some fairly ripe anti-Irish rhetoric has come quite easily to them, hasn't it?
Absolutely. And the problem is that it resurrects all the ghosts of the past, of the sort of colonial attitude of London towards the Irish Republic, about treating it not as it were, as a fully paid-up country.
It's been really weird that from Brexiteers, the genuine indignation that a sovereign state, i.e. the Republic of Ireland, should be seeking to defend its own interests.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, you know, as a completely gratuitous comment here. I find extraordinary parallels here between, you know, Russia and Ukraine and London and the Irish Republic, that there is an absolute unwillingness to recognise that what is seen almost as a region that sort of doesn't deserve to be a fully paid up country has the nerve to behave as though it's a sovereign country. And I think the glory for the Irish Republic here is that possibly for the first time in international diplomacy, it's actually unquestionably on equal terms with the UK. And it has a veto. The small Irish Republic has a veto over this thing that the United Kingdom voted for, and, you know, half the people, more than half the people who voted, want the most, which is to leave Europe. And Irish Republic has a veto.
I've tried to conclude this discussion on a semi-positive note. Most Tory Remainers and quite a lot of Leavers during the campaign reiterated reassurances time and time again that leaving Europe did not necessarily mean leaving the customs union and the single market. Nigel Farage said this, Daniel Hannan said this. They have since the referendum decided that's what it meant after all. Is it possible that the Irish question gives them a way back in? That is, the sort of soft levers in government might be able to advance this as the means of not completely cutting ties.
No. The soft levers are a rapidly disappearing tribe in government. Jeremy Hunt, who was a Remainer, then a soft lever, is now becoming a hard lever. Something to do with his ambitions to lead the party. I don't think the soft levers virtually exist in government at the moment. I do think that Mrs. May and her colleagues are digging themselves into a hole at a furious rate, as not a day goes by when they don't say, we are definitely leaving the customs union and the single market. There is no wriggle room there. I don't see how they can do what you're suggesting. I just can't see a way out of this conundrum. Can I just add as a postscript, and before we finish, that just to add to Meredith, I'm still amused, and I was when I was working full-time in journalism, that news from the Republic always appears on the home news pages. It's not a foreign story. That persists to this day, and that so symbolises the relationship.
And if you're an Irish citizen, you can vote in UK elections, which is something else, which is a legacy of the past and means treating Irish citizens as citizens of something less than a country.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Ivor Gaber and Mary Dujewski. Coming up next, that Time Inc. deal.
Who's up, who's down, and who's out? As the world begins to hunker down for the holidays, we unwrap our annual Soft Power Survey and much more in Monocle's bumper December-January double edition. In a tumultuous year for global politics, we play snakes and ladders with the world's soft power rankings, revealing whose worsening image abroad has seen them take a downward slide and which nations on the charm offensive are climbing to success. We also visit a tiny country with a rich history, San Marino, the world's oldest republic and a nation proud to defend its traditions, crossbow in hand. Next, we grab our first-class tickets, head to our favourite airline lounge and jet into Monocle's annual Travel Top 50. From revamped modernist hotels to the best new high-speed trains, we pack a year's worth of travel highlights into this comprehensive survey. Our voyage continues into the inner workings of National Geographic in our culture pages as we take a peek behind that famous yellow border to see how one of the world's most coveted print titles remained relevant in an ever-changing world. The best is saved until last for you this festive season as our inventory pages unveil Monocle's Christmas gift guide featuring 200-plus present suggestions. From wine and cheese to technology and tools, there's something in here for even the finickiest of friends and family. Monocle's December-January issue is out now. Get your copy today or subscribe at monocle.com.
You're back with Midori House, with me, Andrew Miller. Still with me are Ivor Gaber and Mary Dajewski. Now, the odds on Hillary Clinton ever being named Person of the Year by Time magazine have lengthened considerably, with the news that the venerable weekly's parent publisher, Time Inc., has been purchased by Meredith Corp in a deal financed partially by Charles and David Koch, billionaire brothers not noted for their liberal proclivities. Liberal proclivities, that's a terrible phrase to put in a script you have to read out loud. The all-cash transaction, valued at $2.8 billion, adds to Meredith's portfolio Time, Sports Illustrated, Fortune and People, among others. Ivor, would you spend $2.8 billion of your money on this?
Well, I think it's a very courageous decision that they've made.
Do you mean courageous in the yes minister
indeed,
sense of the word?
Indeed. I mean, I watched Time magazine get slimmer and slimmer, seeking to reinvent itself every other year. It's now features and investigations and backgrounds. I fear it's going to go the way of Newsweek, which I think still exists just.
In some vestigial online shape or form, I think.
Having said that, I'd like to... I hope I'm wrong, because I do see some signs of a revival in long-form print. I mean, I've just been reading Vanity Fair. What a significant... And its circulation and that of The Atlantic and The New Yorker are all booming in the US. And our equivalents here, The Economist, is having record sales.
God bless Donald Trump.
Well, there's an element of that. But Time has a difficulty because it's not really long-form journalism. It tries to be newsy. And how can... daily newspapers obviously can't compete with the web. How does a weekly? So I think this is a very brave move by a relatively... I have to tell you that Meredith Corporation was not in the forefront of my understanding of the US media landscape. But here they are, publishing Good Housekeeping and Farming Today.
So is that your way of saying you hadn't heard of it 24 hours ago?
I might have. No,
of course not.
But not being a Midwestern farmer, no, I hadn't heard of it. So I have to say, I think there's a subtext going on here, as you referred to, and it is the deadly Kay brothers, I fear, maybe egged on by the good president of the United States, are seeking to strike back and claim their own mainstream media.
Well, Donald Trump, of course, Mary, has a peculiar relationship with Time magazine in that he mocked up covers of it, declaring him Person of the Year and hung them on the walls of his golf club. It did actually make him Person of the Year. It kind of comes up with the rations when you get elected President of the United States. And in recent days is claiming that he has already preemptively turned down the title for a second year running, only for Time magazine to then issue a complete flat contradiction of that, suggesting that, again, not for the first time, Trump is just making stuff up. However, he has previously called Time magazine, I quote, paper thin and really flimsy. He's not actually wrong about either
of those
things,
trouble, is he? Isn't it? That's the trouble, that there is a degree of being right about what he said, because as Ivor was saying, you know, the news magazines have got thinner and thinner, and it seems sort of less substantial, even though magazines in general, at least I think in Europe and also in the US, have been to an extent exempt from the appalling fate that's fallen so many newspapers. Nonetheless, those particular sorts of popular news magazines, that at least the UK really has never really specialised in those, that particular genre, but they don't seem to have, they seem to have fallen on very hard times, and it's hard really to see how Time magazine can flourish in the particular stable that it's now in, with these sort of, you know, family orientated sort of women's magazines.
Unless there's a subplot going on. Unless money is no object. The Koch brothers, years ago when I worked in television news, they took over the major TV news agency called UPITN because they thought they could use it as a vehicle for their politics. That does not exist anymore.
Okay, well, finally tonight, recent and ongoing revelations about the atrocious behaviour of powerful men have prompted a doubtless overdue consideration of related matters, language not least among them. France's President Emmanuel Macron has announced a series of proposals on this front, including the outlawing of gender-based insults on pain of fines. Mary, it's a perennial question about the degree to which the law should police language. Is a law like this worth passing, if nothing else, as just one of those declarations of this is the kind of place we are, this is the kind of behaviour up with which we will not put, and so forth?
Well, that's probably the best defence that you can make of it, that, as it were, it sets a standard, it sets a benchmark, and it sets a tone for what's acceptable. But of course, by having a law, if you don't enforce it, then you have to ask, why have it? And people will start mocking it and taking it for granted. But if you do start to enforce it, then you're going to have all sorts of protests and all sorts of whether people are going to get fined. You're going to have sort of trials that people are going to watch and mock. So I think it's a very, very difficult question.
I mean, Ivor, obviously it's preferable to hope that the evolution of manners takes care of this kind of thing. And obviously, I realise that I'm speaking about this as a straight, white, middle-aged male, i.e. one of the, well, no, definitely the least marginalised, oppressed and insulted cohort in the world. But it nevertheless becomes the case with every passing year that I think, in general, it becomes less and less acceptable to make fun of people on the basis of gender, of race, orientation, etc. But is there a way, can the law help that process along?
I think it's really difficult because what happens is oppressed groups or groups see themselves oppressed often reclaim the insult.
Which they're perfectly entitled to do.
But does make it difficult for those who aren't part of that in-group. I will give you a non-inflammatory example. I was discussing this issue with my wife earlier, and she said, yeah, well, things, words like big girl's blouse, which is an English expression, I think it's American, meaning women, it's an insulting term, you know, it's very insulting. And I said, yeah, fine. I work with a radio production, an all-women radio production company that calls itself Big Girl's Blouse. You know, these are very difficult areas.
But in that particular instance, obviously, Mary, they're not using that as an insult. That is a
no. It's a sort of ironic take and sort of to declare an identity. I sort of think two things about this. I think that you are running into trouble. You're setting a benchmark there, which then other people will want to claim. I mean, how many groups are you going to set gender aside or not apply it, say, to race? What happens then? Are you going to extend this law indefinitely? The other thing I would say is that from personal experience, I mean, I spent 2 years working in Paris, and I have to say that France, although maybe it doesn't consider itself like this, but to me, this was one of the least sexist places to work. And it was one of the places you actually got least insulted because you were a woman. And I found that the sort of the courtesy that was shown to women in general in France, practically everywhere, including in Paris, where people say, oh, people are so rude. I almost think that France is the last country that actually needs a law like this.
Isn't male gallantry the flip side of chauvinism? I mean, a lot of women don't like having the door open for them or being shown, given a seat.
I can say that in countries where this doesn't happen, which was my experience of the United States, you end up in actually, there is an enormous amount of pent-up resentment because of the political correctness that people think dictates their behaviour. So, you know, pluses and minuses.
I have never known anybody to object to just the basic common courtesies, and those strike me as they.
Well, I would like to agree with you, but there is a strand of thought, a feminist thought, which says, you know, gender is irrelevant. Men, why should a man give up his seat to a woman? Why doesn't a woman give up a seat to a man? I mean, I do think these are complicated and difficult things. And gender is now, I mean, we won't get into transgender, but gender is now a very contested issue. Can I just add one thing? I was enormously impressed of the Macron announcements. There was a whole series of measures, not just language. The idea that women can stop a bus at night time anywhere without waiting for a bus stop in order to get home safely. I thought that was a terribly sensible idea.
Mary?
Well, I think the other thing to say is that a degree of formality still exists in French life and in French business, which maybe has been lost in quite a lot of the Anglo-Saxon world, where first names apply. And I have to say, I actually quite like being called Madame Dojewski.
Well, that does bring us to the end of today's show. My guests were Ivor Gaber and Madame Dojewski. Thank you both very much for joining us at Midori House. Today's show was produced by Henry Rees Sheridan, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Tom Melville. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. Music next at 1900. It's The Culture Show. I'm back with more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. I'm Andrew Miller. Thank you for listening.